This is the other one, Will. Now, the last time, or since then, there have been a number, since the last lecture, we skipped one, you know, there have been a number of phone calls asking about the people wanting to know more about the last two pictures we showed. That is, the hypocephalus in place and the figure with the name of Abraham above it. Have to be careful here when we get excited. Now, the hypocephalus was found Yes. Just a minute. We're supposed to have something to see by here, aren't we? We're supposed to have a light here?
I don't know.
I need to have some. I can't read when he turns the light off. Isn't that strange? There was always a light before.
I thought you had plenty of inner light.
Oh, no, it won't. It's nice for here. It's fading. It's feeble.
Well, as long as they can hear, whether you can see or not is
All right, well, but then they can't see. Let's sharpen this up. This is in terrible condition. We should do something to this coffin. That's a mess. Look, the darn thing's falling apart. Well, this is the outside of the coffin. What this is here, the hypocephalus is found in the coffin of a lady of very high degree indeed. Her name was Wayabray, and in a tomb which belonged to a larger complex of tombs clustering around the splendid tomb temple of one Angkor. Well, this is the outside of it. When you get closer in, let's look at the next one now. See, this is, when they take the lid off, this is what happens, so I can get this thing out here now. I'm lasering myself here. Ah, there we go. Yes, this is the outside, and what I should have it's maybe on the next one. The interesting thing is, you see, at BYU, we found a mummy far superior to this one a couple of years ago, and they've been playing around with it in Cairo Museum there, and it follows exactly the same pattern from the same time. It's not from the same place though, but the same type. So she was also a royal princess. But this is a bit fuzzy. Is the film heating up or something? It's a very hard machine to adjust, incidentally. That's good, you see. Well, here it is, and when they took it off, here at the bottom is the gold foil where the for the hypocephalus. But let's see now. Oh, excuse me. Oh, damn. This thing is most... Here we go now. Here we go. Now, this is clearer. This is a bit clearer. When he makes it clearer, the man of the machine is going to have a time sharpening it. This is the Urim, but the Tumim is something else. They can't make it exact enough. This shows it very clearly where it was. Now, let's see here what we have. Yes, now this was the face of it. See, there's the lady. You see, it was in terrible condition. But here is the brustlatz, the pectoral. This is very important. She has a pectoral, a shrine. There's a shrine here. This is a pectoral. This is a very important thing. It performs the same office as a hypocephalus on occasions. And you notice the winged creatures all down the front. Very much like the casing of the lady in Cairo that the BYU excavated at Sela, with the same smiling face. Notice it looks like a Greek archaic smile. We won't go into that though. Now, so this whole complex was viewed as the center. It's called the Cairnstick of a necropolis of the old imperial capital of Thebes, according to Mr. Bietok, Professor Bietok. He was the head of a large German expedition team that's been excavated there between 1971 and 1977. It was published in 1980. So see, this is recent, this finding. What they found there, quite near to where they found the Joseph Smith materials, was a much vaster area than they thought, which was a ceremonial center stretching clear along the river, all the way from Deir al-Bahri right up to the Valley of the Kings. It was a processional way there which was used in the so-called Beautiful Valley, a beautiful festival of the valley, or fair festival of the valley. the one occasion once a year when the people, there were a great procession, and the god himself, Amun, was accompanied on a barge and went across the river to Karnak and then came back again. They ferried the whole shebang across the river to Karnak, because this, as the man says, is actually an extension of the temple at Karnak, which is right across the river from it. Well, I think the next one will be a map here, which may show us something. No, well, this is the way the casing looked, and then when it was uncovered, this is what comes out. And this looks exactly like Our Lady, the way it's wrapped in the garlands here. Of course, they're withered, but the one of the BYU mummy was in very good condition indeed. And it's funny, we don't know her name. We know her parents' name, but don't know her name. This one you do know her name, see? And she is Wahyabre. And that's what we have here. And now we'll find out about her. But this is very important because of where it was found and the conditions. It shows us a totally different setup from what any was ever conceived before. The Germans really did a thorough job when they got in there in the 70s, and they found it was quite a different layout from one had supposed before. And here is the map here. And it's this area along the river. Here, right in here, see? Notice Thebes is directly across the river from Karnak. And there's Luxor, and Karnak are right together in Thebes. And there's Negadal, the oldest cemetery of them all. And then it runs down to Hermon. This is all very archaic, the ancient center, and the Valley of the Kings right in here. Abydos up there. This is the old stuff down here. But they had this, all along here was a sacred area here, and the procession, when they would go to on this festival and on other occasions, everybody was invited to join in and follow in the train of Amun. You notice, I want to be one in thee, I want to be one of thy followers. This, whether it's of Ray or whether it's of Amun, can be someone else. Usually it's of Ray, let me be one. Because it's your only way of gaining immortality is to hack in, to get into the train of the one who is circling eternally, who is on an eternal trip. And Professor Bitok has shown the whole layout on the western bank of the Nile from Deir al-Bahrein to the Valley of the Kings, with a scene of grandiose rites and processions connected with the fair festival of the valley, quoting him, as a sort of extension of the Amun cult of Karnak, with splendid processions on the west bank, which not only blessed the dead, but it says, the Angehörigen to Verstorben, but anyone who belongs to the family, anyone's welcome to join in this parade here, those who belonged or were connected with the dead, as well as the god who was going, or if it was for a very important funeral, anybody could join in, apparently, here. To make a long story short, the Germans are both laborious and thorough in these three volumes. They did a tremendous work on it. It seems that there was much more going on in and around the cemetery where the Joseph Smith papyri were found, because they're right together there, than has ever been supposed. The place was a sort of Western Karnak, he says, a great processions of the followers of Amun sweeping all along in the great festival that crossed the river and returned. The center was called this, the great temple of millions of years, the temple of Jeser-Jeseru. He left that untranslated. Jeser, the same word as Deseret. Put the feminine on it for the land or the valley, and it's Deseret, you see. Jeser-Jeseru means the holy of the holiest, the holy of holies. This was the temple, Deseret of Deseret. Deseret means both red land, holy, means set apart, sacred, holy, the same as the Hebrew Kadosh. So it is the Jeser-Jeseru, and its excellent situation, as Treffenstein said, of the primal time, of the first time, it goes back, this is the title, it's an elaborate title, but reads again here, the great temple of millions of years, the temple of Jeser-Jeseru, in its excellent situation back in the primal time, the Tepsepi, the time in the beginning, when all these things were formed in the beginning. All this is much older, see. It must all be traced back to the other world and was transferred down here, as if you would as if you'd make a transplant, what would we say when you, as if you would cast a plant on a screen or something like this. It was first put on the earth, and then it was duplicated down here from above in heaven. That comes out very clearly in a writing called the El Arish, a very early inscription found on the border between Palestine and Jerusalem, Palestine and Egypt. This great temple, it's all that was much older. It goes back, they've been doing this thing since the 11th dynasty, since before 2000 BC. It's been there the time, and on a much vaster scale, much wider, everybody was engaged in it. Now, this lady belongs to the complex of Angkor, who is a very great noble indeed. And we have eight of his titles, which, do I have anything of Angkor here? See what it is. No, this shows how they, now which one is this? Is this the, there it fades out again. Is it that same machine that will not focus? The first time we had a machine, you couldn't focus at all. It must be the same one. That's better. But you notice this is like these mummies, there's scads of them. These are all royal mummies of important people. This is the way they're Lobolo, remember they're described there in bunches and groups, and they were. He says they get the word he uses is most more or less clustered in bunches and groups around this holy place. So they turned out in great numbers, and of course during the days of the raiders, and we're going to see the time and place of this discovery is very important here. During the grave, they just plundered them from museums, and they destroyed everything they couldn't take with them. It was terrible. That's supposed to be a beam of light coming down in the center. But this is the way where they're found in great bunches set aside. Well, of course, during the late kingdom and during a time of crisis, they would do this. They would bustle even kings' mummies would be hustled and bustled into a safer place to be put there for safekeeping. So when things get tight, all sorts of things can happen when a great king like Sheshonq would have to have his silver sarcophagus broken in the process of being shifted quickly from one place to another for security. Time comes when the greatest societies aren't too secure. Well, that's, well. Now, the eight titles of this Angkor shows his gratis honorum to he's climbed the ladder of success to the highest official and ecclesiastical offices. He was probably a member of the court, Bitok concludes, but he was tutor to the royal children, which is pretty high when you can get to be that, you know, because the royal children held their tutor in reverence, even equal to their fathers. And we have here, the reason I mentioned this there, we have the names of these mummies, and they're all related to each other one way or another. There's 166 names in this particular tomb. And their family, you can reconstruct genealogies from them. Makes it very useful because they intermesh with the extensive genealogy of the family of the people that Henniker discovered with the Joseph Smith in the days of Lobolo. They're right next, and the families are interrelated, in other words. These people belong to the same family, probably, that Joseph and the Joseph Smith papyri do. Certain Greek archons and people like that, important people. Oh, that's in the Ptolemaic period. And this extends, this particular grave, this isn't this one, you see, but this is typical of what it was like. This is in rather bad condition, but they've done an awful lot of work on it. It dates from the 26th, this one, from the 26th to the 30th dynasty. That is from the time of Lehi. He dates the man himself about 586-87, which is exactly the day when Lehi left Jerusalem. So it's the very period of Lehi and extends down to the Ptolemaic period in the 4th century BC. So these are important people. Their names are connected. They may all be, genealogical schemes may be tied in with the names of complex to which the Joseph Smith, from which the Joseph Smith papyri came. They all date from this particular time. Well, meticulously thorough in everything else, the excavators have given unusually short shrift to that hypocephalus we showed you, that thing in this. And this is all it says about it. It receives the shortest possible notice and nothing more. Nobody pays any attention to these things. It simply says, at the head is a hypocephalus of gold foil, like a halo was pasted to the floorboard. A Bodenbrett is as good, floorboard is as good as anything for Bodenbrett, that's what it was. We already showed you the picture. We don't need to go back to it, I suppose. That's very interesting, though. It's gold, and he immediately calls it a Heiligenschein, a golden halo, a glow, because we just talked about the Abraham story where Abraham left a crown, a sun crown behind with, and it's supposed to be the sun, you see, a sun crown behind with Isaac, and it retained the light after Abraham was gone. So the connection between heaven and earth, this is the function of a hydrocephalus after all. And then the angel came to take it away, and either Isaac or Abraham complained, there are different versions, and he let it stay for a few days, some say 12 days, and it stayed a while. But the idea that this hypocephalus, in the Abraham story, you see, he leaves this gold crown shining on the head of Isaac when he goes away. It's the glory of the sun and the moon, he says, which will be with it, and will stay with it, will linger with him for a while. Of course, that's the purpose of the hypocephalus, for the spark of life to linger until the spirit is ready to come back and occupy the body again. The golden halo should stir at least some interest here, where the last thing we noted was the golden halo of light which Abraham left around the head of Isaac when he ascended to heaven, a halo which retained the light of the sun to comfort the body with its rays while the spirit was away. That's what we're told in the seventh section of the Testament of Abraham. Now, there's more to this quaint sketch than meets the eye. This is the quaint sketch. Now, the other one, talking about the other one. That's a beautiful piece of work, isn't it? Well, there is more to this quaint sketch than meets the eye. Nothing could be more amateurish than the drawing, and the spelling is just as bad, which is a help, too, because then they're able to see you. It comes close enough. You don't expect grammatical perfection, cases and case endings, and moods to be correct. But since the magical charms from the late period are legion, this could come from anywhere. These are one number by thousands. You pick them up everywhere. Ah, but not this one. This is a special one. John Gee phoned me yesterday. He was able to look it up in Berkeley. We didn't have the volume of the Greek magical papyri. It was here. And he tells me that, of course, it's registered there what's the name? Preisendonce tells about it. And this work of art was discovered by Anastasi in 1828 in the Theban Cemetery, just the very same time that the Joseph Smith ones were picked up. And hey, you're there, aren't you? You didn't call from Berkeley, did you? Do we have it here? Oh, there's a real comedy of errors about my trying to find this yesterday. It's a scream, you'd laugh yourself sick, but I'm not going to tell about it. It's our super security. They wouldn't even let me into the room where it was, so I had to go out to the bookstore and read it out there. That's true. Oh, dear. You can tell me about it then. It was found, you say, by Anastasi in the Theban Cemetery, which puts things pretty close. The locale is, you're getting pretty close there, the tombs of Gurnia, where the Joseph Smith mummies were found. In other words, it's not just it could have been found in thousands of places, from Alexandria to Nubia, as far as that goes, and from almost any period. Well, the late period is pretty bad, around the first century, something like that. But it hits the time and place very nicely. And what about this Abraham? That's of all the countless times and places the thing could have turned up, it chose this time and place and fits most closely into our picture. Now let's see what you got here. Now, there's an English translation of the Greek magical papyri for sale at the bookstore. That's the one I consulted, and it's edited by my friend Janet Johnson. I was in a class with her. There were three of us in a class with Professor Wilson in early Egyptian inscriptions, and she was one of them, a strict and loyal disciple of the Chicago school. The rule being in the class that you should never ask questions. It shocked them if you ask a question, which was surprising. And Professor Wilson didn't like it at all. But she translated, and I think that may have been the reason why she deliberately overlooked this, because this is really quite important as far as that goes. You'll notice you'll recognize the name of Abraham. Well, she was from Wyoming, and she knew about the Book of Abraham. After all, I was there in class too, and as I say, from Wyoming, I strongly suspect that she knows more about it than she let on. But this English translation, the Greek magical papyri, is edited by Miss Johnson, a strict disciple of the Chicago school. Did she refuse to see the possible significance of certain Gnostic terms which she leaves untranslated? Aedio here. this first one. Aedios is one of the very, very favorite words they use. It's not a common word in Greek, but it's common in the Gnostic writings. If you read in all Hermetic writings, Aedios, it means not particular, therefore not limited, especially not limited in time, therefore it means eternal. It means eternal, everlasting, and infinite. A very popular word with them, a favorite Gnostic term, denoting what is not closely limited or defined, what is particularly limitless in time, infinite, and eternal. Well, something as far as the notice, was it a dative or something like that? Remember, the person may not be so good at spelling. And the next one, for oric, I'm quite sure that must be oricos, which is another word they like. For oricos, we don't have to worry about the spelling. Oricos, which means in the full bloom of youth. It means with every part in place and functioning. It means at the height of life. It means it does mean the flower of youth is what it means. And in its everything in its proper and perfect form. And the third word here, the nusrenithambito, is a real Gnostic word. It's probably an optithem from thambito, which is pronounced thambito. You see, they were spelling by ear thambito, thamboito. Of course, today it would be thambito. It means let him be amazed, let him be surprised, let him be astonished. It's a common thing. When he sees his true nature, or when he sees his pre-existence, or when this particular process comes, let him be amazed, let him marvel. At this Gospel of Thomas, Gospel of Philip, you have that idea. You marvel if you know that your true situation and so forth. So let him be amazed, something like that. And then the Gnostics often invite such amazement. Well, all three of these expressions are particular to the resurrection situation, aren't they? To be eternal. To be infinitely youthful, to be in blooming youth, everything, and to marvel at the fact. Then comes Abraham. Then she puts who at there, and then planoi. Well, you immediately recognize plano. People are always planoi. Plano, that means to go astray. So someone's go astray. Planoi ek, probably ek. Plano ek, going astray from what? This is probably one of those fancy names of which there are thousands in Gnostic literature, very often ending in oath, something like that. We'll have to spend more time with it as far as that goes, see what it is. But it's talking about Abraham. There's a marvel here, and there's the opposition, those who go astray from something or other. And then she goes on, you see, and she says, Muru, you can guess at that one, and the whole soul for her, talking about some woman, the female body, and I conjure thee to inflame, well, the person using it to his own interest. But then this is particular. Remember that 162 section of the Book of the Dead, or the Berlin 3031, which begins this, which instructs the person who makes the hypocephalus to write these words together with this picture on a new papyrus. He says the very same thing here. It's a regular formula as far as that goes, but the instructions, write these words together with the picture on new papyrus, are fairly standardized, yet they happen also to match perfectly the instructions for making a hypocephalus in the Berlin and the Book of the Dead. So there we are. This is not irrelevant that Abraham's name should be there, but some of our boys should put some more study in on it, I'm sure of that. Of course, as a work of art, it deserves close consideration and analysis, I'm sure. Well, it's the name of Abraham. I mean, there's no doubt what it is, you see. Well, now that's important. We're going to see some of that later on, but let's see what we've written here. I'm curious to know. Yes, here we go. Well, having missed a week, begin the introduction now. Having missed a week after the first five talks, it'd be well briefly to review some high points here. We noted the pre-modern view that the Egyptians possessed great mysterious wisdom, from Herodotus to Athanasius Curtius, you know, the mysteries of the Egyptians. The cracking of hieroglyphic code was followed by, in the late 19th century, by general disappointment and disillusionment. Finally, even disgust, such persons as Ehrman and Gardner, are actually disgusted with the absurdities of the whole thing. It's a frightful absurdity. Interesting in spite of that, they say. In particular, it appeared that their chief concern was the forlorn and illogical project of defeating death. Edward Meyer's passage on that. But recently things have taken a different turn. It was never a question of getting the best of death. None have given more grisly, clinical descriptions of death what death does to mortals, and it is absolutely inescapable. And the Egyptians themselves say, like the 154th section of the Book of the Dead, curl your hair when you read that. They knew what death was, of course, and they knew they wouldn't escape it. But they recognize it as an absolute necessity if the process of life was to continue indefinitely. It can't go on the way it is here. Rest and refreshment were what it offered. O eldest God, enter... No, this is a quotation from the 69th chapter of the Book of the Dead. O eldest God, enter and tell the collector of writings, the doorkeeper of Osiris, that Osiris so-and-so is come, blessed, divine, and powerful. He has done away with the suffering of his last illness. He's not sick anymore. Osiris becomes powerful and divine by resting in the resting place of Osiris. In other words, death is a short period of R&R, recreation, rest and recreation, not recreation, but what you think of it. He has been reborn with him. He is verily a youth, and so forth. A period of rest, recuperation, other terms. It was possible by fusing the corpse on a bier with a radiant... Did I put this rest in rest business here? No, this illustrates what happens now. This is sort of a review, you see. It was possible by... the fusing of the corpse on the bier with a radiant spirit from above. And this is shown in so many different forms, it's always plain what they have in mind. You don't have to stick to one standard form, you see, and say, oh, this isn't that, it's something else. Could be something else. They're free to use this because it's a vocabulary that they can use. Now, you're not really a bird, you're not really wings. That eyes don't have wings, they knew that. But the sun is certainly sending down rays here. The person is rising. He's receiving the sun on his own head, you see, he's receiving it to himself. And he's in the process of rising. This is a rather spiritual representation. They use the wings for spirit, and of course for negotiating the empty space between heaven. The word is shu for them, which means both space, and it means the light beams and the spirit and everything else. And here they go between, and they extend down from the wedge-out eyes, which means the complete restoration is guaranteed. What's going to happen here? Well, it suggests these things. It was possible by fusing them together, the radiant spirit, his own Baha. It was the uniting of Re with Osiris, thanks to the freedom with which the divine person could take on the nature and identity of one another for a given operation. Thus, in one chapter of the Book of the Dead, 31, we read, I am the bull presiding over the fields. I am truly Osiris, whom his father Geb and his mother Nut, to whom they were sealed. And that's the word it uses. I am Horus the Elder, same guy, you see. I'm Horus the Elder on the day his father, on the day of the festival. I am Anubis on the day of the centipede. See, for a particular occasion, you would identify with a particular person in a particular function and still be yourself. I am truly Osiris. I have come. I have saved my own body. We think of Abraham when he came, when the same character says, I am the soul dwelling in my progeny. This means that Osiris, when he entered the Mendes, found the soul of Re there. This is an explanation given by a scribe. This means that when Osiris entered Mendes, he found the soul of Re there. They embraced each other and became one complete person again. Well, we saw that again. In the instant of the embrace, they effected the resurrection. This union, which Horning designates as Jeba Demji, is the final solution to all our earthly problems, which are brought upon us consciously or unconsciously, by the eternal footman. See, that's what worries them, the one thing, you see. Well, it's a nice theory that this can happen. Let's see if we have anything here. Yes, it is the very, very famous one, you see, from... Yes. The awakening of Osiris. Still can't even read it from here. And if it's in that big print, and you can't read it from here. Can't we get it clearer than that? I think they have the bad machine. No, there she goes. You see, fussy machine that won't work. He's being awakened, but you notice the bird here. It's Ammon. Well, he can be Ammon too. He says he's that, but it's his own spirit coming down to greet him. But he is rising. He's not being mummified, and he's not embalmed. Well, this is noted, as it says here, the awakening of Osiris is what it is here. And there are the two ladies. They're no longer mourning him, they're watching, I suppose, in amazement as what has happened. Here's his Nephthys, and here's... but here is Isis, but as Hathor. Notice, Isis is Hathor, the mother goddess, the cow, which we have here. And here is Nephthys, who is the lady of the house. So he's rising there, and then here's the one of the king. This is from Dendera, I think. Yes. This is vividly, shows it quite vividly, you see. Again, if he could ever focus the darn thing. Modern. Again, notice that this is the bird with the bird's head. They say, oh, that bird should have a human head because that's a Ba bird in the Joseph Smith. No, it doesn't have human head. This doesn't. This is a bird. This is your Aku. Remember your bird of light that comes, ascends as a beam of light. The Aku comes down. It is his own spirit, but it is also Horus the hawk. Horus being the successor to the father is the Horus. See that? And here, you notice Anubis is no longer engaged in the business of wrapping him up. Anubis is often shown carrying vessels, a vessel and cloth here, and oil here, to embalm the person. He's not doing it here. He's in the attitude of dua, or praise. He is both amazed and he is praising the what is happening here. The spirit has come down, is joining the body. He is beginning to talk, you see, he's beginning to raise up. And here is the... this is Anubis. Is that Horus here? Okay. Or is it Sobek? That would be the family. That would be the family. Well, they're all are amazed and all are pleased with what's going on, and they're all in the attitude of prayer now. They're not embalming the person at all. See, there's a great variety of these lion couch scenes. You can't be stuck with them. Now here, for example, he is embalming the person. Here he's using, it's the opening of the mouth thing. Here's the using the nu, or the setup sign, this made of meteoric iron, which is supposed to make contact again with the heavens to get him talking. Here's the stuff of embalm and so forth. This is a different scene entirely. The ladies are making magic passes of protection and so forth, and Anubis is performing his office of embalmment. But it's the opening of the mouth, the final opening of the mouth. So these things have different uses here. Different context is totally different from the other. You can't immediately leap for a conclusion. Now, here is a grand ensemble of the whole thing. Here the person lies there, but notice Horus is coming down from above, upside down. They just make contact. Horus makes contact with him. And that is, again, it's not very clear, to say the least. There, every once in a while he hits it, that's right. And here is the well-known ram, you see, the ram, he's clear. This is the ram at midnight, the lowest level that he reaches, you see presently. Notice there's the double lion that represents the passing between past and present, and the parrot. He goes forth, you see, and here's the ma'u, he beholds. And here is the ram this is the ram that begins, and here's the ram coming forth. And here is Anubis, the faithful dog, who's performed his office of watching. Here are the mothers, the two ladies now are his mothers and so forth. And all along here is the duat. It's all engaged in the upper, with stars. It's all the cosmical plan. And here are the 12, the various gates, you see. This is a prayer at the house, and this is the duat. This is the duat of the head nature. And this is the praise to the gods, and this is a prayer to the one who is in the duat. There's the lower dot, you see, to the one who is a duat, a prayer, duat to Yimu dot, to the one who is in the prayer. And here's a duat to the An, and here's a duat to the Asha, to the many, Asha Heru, the one of many faces, apparently. But see, it's a grand ensemble. You have to bring together all sorts of forces and conditions and times. Everything has to be right. What does Shakespeare play? Time right, hands apt, drugs fit, and time agreeing. Yes, thoughts black, hands apt, drugs fit, and time agreeing. Certain things must all come together if you're going to perform magic. See, as far as this goes, and that's what we have here, and. This is the Joseph Smith version. Now, which one of these is this, you see? He is not... Is he holding the knife? There's no reason why he couldn't be. Again, he has the hands raised. Actually, characters have stubbornly denied that these are fingers. The men at Chicago said, those aren't fingers or hands at all. And Joseph Smith himself, how do they know Joseph Smith, do they? But we've seen enough of those in which they're hands. Of course they're hands. Look, his legs are raised. He's not being embalmed as a mummy at all. That person who's being embalmed in a mummy, as you saw in the last one, is never shown wearing a normal garment, nor a normal cindet or apron that comes down to the knees. He's going to be on his way. And again, they said, oh, this bird should have, Joseph Smith has put a bird's head on there. He has faked it. Should have the head of a person, you see. Well, we just saw there are plenty of birds coming down there. It doesn't have to be the one that is. How bigoted and how narrow we can get in these things. And then this is a brand new element not found in the others, which shows it's a sacrificial theme as far as that goes. That is Sobek. Well, let's get on with this. But this was... this is a nice theory about the body and the soul coming together and for resurrection. We certainly don't have the power to control any of this operation. All we can do is call for help, and that's what happens. The purpose of the hypocephalus is to convey that plea for someone to rescue us. Remember, every one of them has either a prayer to be rescued or an answer to that prayer. The prayer is answered by a divine heavenly being of overpowering brilliance who descends from above. It's our own spirit returning from where it dwelt in the radiance before we were born down here. Contact is made with this person and with the realms above by a special device, the hypocephalus, like the light shaft we showed before. They work more than one way. The Egyptians liked a lot of overkill. They tried every possible way, and this is why so much has survived. They cover every inch with inscriptions and so forth. They don't waste. They pour it on if you're going to do it. They thought by mere insistence, things so massive, they overdid things. I was simply astonished this last time I was back there at how much more massive and huge things had to be, were than they ever had to be. They would have lasted just as long if they'd been half as big. No, they had to make sure of everything. Well, the hypocephalus is designed to maintain an unbroken tie between the body below and the spirit above by retaining a spark of life, fire and life within the head, thus preserving the body as well against the time when the spirit shall descend to rejoin it. On the same hypocephalus, the owner may refer to him or himself as Osiris NM, naming his father and mother, as Re, as Atum, as Khnum, as Horus. Osiris himself says, takes hundreds of forms. Here's one from the very first chapter of the Book of the Dead, which covers the whole ground pretty well. He says, I follow Horus in Rostau and Osiris in Mendes, his town of the ram. I was the ritual reader of the ram, Lord Mendes. This is believable thanks to the perfect confirmation in nature of the Heperu. Now, we talked about Heperu, which is written with the beetle. That refers especially to the changes of form in the process of time, in which each man in his time plays many parts, as Shakespeare says. Quite literally, changing from one form to another, he lives out this strange, eventful history. Now, this is the principle of Heper. This is the Joseph Smith version of it. There's no reason in the world why that shouldn't be accurate, because they faked nothing else, you see. They claimed, remember, that almost everything in it was faked until they found the original. They found that nothing was faked, as was found on the original. Hedlock had faked anything. He'd done a very good copy, actually. So, there's the Bach. Now, here has his own face, you see. This is the lady's own face here. But notice, here is Anubis, who is the embalmer. And you say, well, yes, he's the embalmer. He performs a very important function. So he's also referred to the enemy. Not uncommon phrase is, save me from the hands of Anubis. Don't let Anubis get me, and so forth. He can represent, see, the enemy. Because, after all, he cuts the fatal... I guess Herodotus or Diodorus tells us, he cuts the fatal stab in the abdomen of the person to remove all the insides and so forth, and that's regarded as a sacrifice. And the priest who makes the cut is driven out as someone who's committed a terrible crime. So it has to be a sacrificial death. It has to be sacrificed. And Anubis takes the place, whether the priest wore an Anubis mask or not. It would be someone attempting to sacrifice. Well, Abraham, if you want. Remember, they're trying to express these things in familiar images. And here he's performing an embalming. The spirit is returning. And notice the spirit is the breath of life. Use the two standard signs for breath. There's a sail with wind in it, which illustrates what breath is, and of course the anik sign, the sign of life. This is the breath of life which the bird has come to restore. And obviously, you see, it's the bird of light. And nobody ever saw a bird that looked like that, but they didn't say so. This is the idea. Something comes down, the bright, brilliant thing that comes down, and it's your own spirit and comes to you. They didn't want to be too literal about this because they could be caught on that. They're just, and again, you notice rising from here is a lotus. I mean, instead of a hypocephalus, he has a lotus here, and it's the lion couch. Well, we have to get on here before, so we can get on to the talk. Now, here's your heparu, here's your beetle, you see. And as it says, Ramses, often at sunset and at sunrise, the sun has to pass through these various phases. And as each man in his time plays many parts, of which there are seven acts, so we have our 12 acts of the day the sun has to go through. And he changes form in each one. So you will in the next life, you'll change your form. But you do it here, they say, and you're still the same person. So here he praises him, coming forth, and this is your festivals for the occasion. But here you see, here's the ram passing forth. Here is the eye, from eye to eye, the sunrise to the sunset. But Heper, this means he's going to undergo changes, and this means, who does it? The climax of the change, the figure that represents the change is always this ram. Let's hope we can get the next one clear. That was good, though. Oh, there's one. Now notice, this, oh, already it fades. I'm afraid they have that inferior machine here now. Look at that. Ah, good, thank you. And now look, here is the ram, but look, it talks about the ram that does all sorts of things here. This is the Ensobit, this is the king, as the ram who lives in Re. This is the ram who lives in Shu. This is the ram who lives in Isis. This is the ram who lives in Osiris, goes up here, who lives in Osiris. Each time it's done, these are the double rams of the double kingdoms, of both of them. See, this is going to represent anything. This is the ram who is the heir, who's the inheritance in the land of Tachinen. That is the first land that was inhabited on earth. The first land, garden, it was Eden, the first land that emerged on this earth. And so it goes, but always represented by a ram, always represented by a ram, who is the one who is, and he's sacrificing to him here, showing that you can go through these various heparu. It's very well illustrated in this one. Oh no, well, this is a good one too. You notice it uses, every time it uses the heparu here. Here is, this is heparu, the becoming of becomings. The heparu is, and then the next one, you see, the next one is the heparu now, the comings of the two heparu of Tachinen. That's the first land. The next one adds three heparu, the heparu now belonging to the three heparus of Tachinen, and here it goes to the eight. It finally goes to the eight rams, which is the height, when you reach the height of the day or the night, or the height of the night, when it's time to begin a new cycle, you reach the eight rams, which are often found drawn out, sometimes all eight rams, on hypocephali. Believe it or not, they're represented on the Joseph Smith one. Well, this one, now this shows it very nicely, you see, what we're doing. I say Hebrew represents change in time. Here you start out as a child, that's the sign of the infant, the tongue, the thumb in the mouth and so forth, sign of an infant. Here the infant is throned. Here you have the coming forth, here's the good of the lion, but he's on the lotus, the nefertum. Full day, dawn coming, you see, completely. Here he comes, here comes a ram and takes authority. This is when he grows older. Here he receives a crown, oh, it's not clear here. That's the ray, that's the crown, it's the sun. And when here's a high noon, he has, I guess you can't make that any sharper. That shows the Atif crown, that triple crown, and the four-headed ram. The four-headed ram and the triple crown, which is the center of every hypocephalus. That's the one. That represents the peak, the height, the moment of change from one cosmic order to another. Now look at that, would you? And the same things go on here. See, this is the one. Can you get that clearer? Ah, there, just for a fleeting moment. This is the way it used to be with the old-fashioned astronomers applause, there you see the foreheads and so forth. And then here it's the night part. And then he gets older and older, you see. Here is the ram. It's the ram each time. And here is the monkey who measures the hours. That's another thing. We have the monkey measuring the hours on the Joseph Smith papyrus anyway. And he's getting weaker and older and older and older. And now he's shedding everything, and now he's ready to collapse. This is the end, you see. So these are the 12 hours. They're shown in different ways here. But the idea is he's progressing in age here, but always represented for some reason by a ram. Well, the ram begins the year, Aries, and all that sort of thing. So now let's see what we have here. I'm sorry to, well. So, the same, well, yes. We found that the plot and characters and lines from which one recognizes consistent drama are set forth in the ascriptions of the Book of the Dead, 162 in Berlin, and so forth, also, which we call the handbook or user's guide, and in full-scale ritual plays that have been handed down from before the Old Kingdom, very ancient. They would really dramatize this and carry it out. We saw in the Book of the Dead and the Coffin Text, Book of the Dead 78, Coffin Text 312, which go back to the 11th dynasty. The same story is told, we saw last time, in the Testament of Abraham and in the Apocalypse of Abraham, which was proclaimed by a band of experts to have been, of course, Egyptian origin and used the imagery and came from the Book of the Dead, was written by a Jew who knew all about Egyptian, or probably by an Egyptian anyway. But anyway, it brings Abraham into the scene. Well, now, the Apocalypse begins with Abraham speaking as he does in the Book of Abraham, in the first person, which is very rare in Apocalypse. But this is shown, the older versions all have it, the later ones don't, but it shows a sign of great age that you... And he starts out by saying this, and I'm talking about the Apocalypse of Abraham, which was discovered in 1863. It had been brought from the Holy Land by Russian pilgrims in the Middle Ages before it was found in Russia, and it's in the in Moscow, the museum there, or in the Hermitage. I was searching as to the mighty God. He starts out, Abraham is oppressed by the idolatry of his fathers, and he starts out, I was searching as to who the mighty God in truth is. I, Abraham, when I fulfilled services of my father Terah to his gods of wood and stone. Begins, as the Book of Abraham does, with I, Abraham, in a powerless condition with his own family. He was indeed searching, for later, he says in the Book of Abraham 2 and 12, I said in my heart, thy servant has sought thee earnestly, now I have found thee. Indeed, Abraham, Apocalypse begins by saying, I was searching as to who the mighty God is. And here he tells us in the second chapter of the Book of Abraham, I have sought thee earnestly, now I have found thee. We saw last time that the theme of both Abraham Apocrypha is resurrection. The experts certainly looked the other way. Significant that G.H. Box in 1918, who edited the text the first time, says the book apparently knows nothing of a resurrection, and all it talks about is resurrection. On his journey, Abraham sees fiery wheels, and each wheel full of eyes over wheels over wheels was a throne. We'll see that later. This we should bear in mind hereafter. It's what he says about the powers of heavenly bodies comes strikingly close to the explanation of Joseph Smith's facsimile 2. It says here, Abraham is talking about the heavens, which is being shown him in a drawing by the angel, and the angel is pointing out things with his finger, see? Upon this firmament there were no other powers of other form, but only angels of spirit, like the power which I saw on the seventh firmament. And I saw there were on the fifth firmament the powers of stars, which carried out the commands laid upon them, and the elements of the earth obeyed them. Well, this is the hypocephalous language. When we read in facsimile 2, figure 2, Joseph Smith says, stands next to Kolob, holding the key of power, also pertaining to other planets. One of the governing planets also said to the by the Egyptians to be the sun, and to borrow its light from Kolob through the medium of K, which is the grand key, or in other words, the governing power. This planet receives power through the mediate of Akokabim. Well, power is mentioned four times there, you see. And interesting, so when we're told in the Apocalypse that the commands were laid upon them and the elements of the earth obeyed them, So we read in Abraham 4:10 and 12 and 18 and 21, at the creation of the earth, the gods commanded the elements, and the gods saw that they were obeyed. It's the very same thing, gods are commanding the elements. We're following the same pattern very closely here, I think. Not only the powers, but especially the hierarchy or the level of powers is conspicuous. Both talk about various levels of heavens and powers and so forth. In the Apocalypse, the angel instructs Abraham, quote, look not beneath thy feet. That's a repeated praise that occurs a number of times here. At the firmaments, he says, excuse me, look now beneath thy feet. Typewriters do that all the time, don't they? Look now beneath thy feet at the firmaments and understand the creation foreshadowed in this expanse, the creatures existing in it, and the age prepared according to it. And Abraham, Book of Abraham, says in the third chapter, the fifth verse, the planet which is the lesser light is above or greater than that which thou stand on which thou standest. That on which thou standest is repeated seven times in that chapter, and beneath thy feet is repeated in the other one four times. So in beneath thy feet is that on which thou standest, of course. He says, look down on to that on which below that on which thou standest. Or it's above either one, but always in terms of the point of which you're viewing it. Because it standeth above the earth upon which thou standest. A repeated phrase. The Abraham Apocrypha, full of things like this, our singular feature. Well, the Lord shows Abraham a picture of the cosmos. Now, it's called the cosmos, see here, and of course, cosmos is the world we live in. It's the regular, those who are of the world, they use the word for cosmos for it. See, the same thing. It's called, it could be the universe or the world, but he makes a diagram of it. That's the point. The Lord shows Abraham a picture of the cosmos divided in half, as are all regular hypocephali, and he explains, whatever I determined to be was already planned beforehand in this picture, and it stood before me ere it was created. He points out in the picture people set apart, and others whom I have ordained to be born of thee and to be called my people. Of course, all this in the book of Abraham too, in the third chapter again, 22nd verse. Now the Lord had shown unto me, Abraham, the intelligences that were organized before the world was, and he stood in the midst of them, and he said, these I will make my people. Abraham, thou art one of them. Exactly the same thing. He says, he saw this plan beforehand. He says to Abraham, others who I have ordained to be born of thee and to be called my people. And he says to Abraham, book of Abraham, these I will make my people. Abraham, you are one of them. Abraham knows he's to be the leader because many nations will be blessed in him. Well, we mention these things here because they do refer to the hypocephalus, the picture or diagram to set everything out by way of explanation. A diagram not necessarily the same as that on the hypocephalus, there could have been others, but employing the same method of teaching, which is our purpose here. Again, you see in Abraham 12 and 14, he says, right at the very beginning, he says these things. In the Amduet, a very important work belonging to the kings, the tombs of the kings from the New Kingdom, it says what Abraham is told here, right at the beginning, I say, 1, 12, and 14, yes. And it came to pass, and that you may, he's writing for his children, Abraham is, and that you may have a knowledge of this altar, I refer you to the representation at the commencement of this record. Then he says later, and that you may have an understanding of these gods, I have given you the fashion of them in the figures at the beginning, which manner the figures are called by the Chaldeans, Rahlenos, which signifies hieroglyphs. Well, I won't go into that name yet, but this very important writing that all the kings, only for kings, called the Amduet, the writer often says, you will find this represented in a sketch on such and such a wall, in such and such a room, or in such and such a place. The same thing, I refer you to it here. So that's what they do. They refer you to diagrams, and Abraham says, in the Egyptian fashion, I'm referring to the way the Egyptians represented these things. Not that Abraham himself is committed, remember, Pharaoh only has a darn good imitation of the right thing, but Abraham uses it. And when Abraham found himself back on the earth, he says, no longer in glory in which I was on high, my soul longed to understand, in my heart I do not understand. Now this is from the ascension of Abraham, you see. Whereas, this reminds us, of course, of Moses.
the presence of God withdrew from Moses, that his glory was not upon him. The Egyptian says, it was no longer in glory on which I was on high. God withdrew from Moses, his glory was not on Moses. And Moses was left to himself, and he fell into the earth and said unto himself, lo, for this cause I know that man is nothing, which thing I never had supposed. Here we have Abraham and Moses together, and both men have plainly more to learn, and both take note of their lamentable inadequacy. Now, the Deva Jemni, the final method of bringing the body and spirit together, you see, is the answer to the terrible question, but only if it's literally true. Now, this is the point. It's all right to be talking about this as a nice theory and so forth, but the Egyptians say we must go beyond theory, and these are sketches, these are elaborations. They thought they were being, well, scientific. They represent certain sophisticated equations and things like that. We do things almost as wild, you know, when we draw things, but that is why Now the question is then, what if this took place, when did it take place, and who saw it? Who witnesses? You must know. Well, that's the whole purpose here. The same is asked about the resurrection of the Lord by the apostles after the resurrection of those. The answer is that only the individual experiencing these things has certain knowledge, of course. That's why he is always stringently required to make out a full report with charts and diagrams for less favored mortals, in particular his own progeny, and distributed as wisely as possible among them, but only to those qualified to receive it. For them it must be guarded absolutely. Remember how the book of first chapter of Moses ends, in a time when these write all these things, and in the time when my word shall be esteemed as not by the children, they shall be had again among the children of the men, among as many as shall believe. They're to be guarded very secretly, and we saw right at the beginning here, the instructions for making a hypocephalus, it must be kept top secret, only known to the person who wrote it, except those he addresses that he can trust, family and so forth. Now, a remarkable witness to the story of Abraham's ascension is given in the verses which Joseph Smith filled out in the earlier biblical account pointed out by Talmudy the last time. In the Joseph Smith account, the inspired version of Genesis 15 and 7 following, remember, the last time we saw that the ascension and testament of Abraham follow after, of course, the 15th chapter of Genesis, which has baffled everybody. Nobody knows what it's about, what it belongs. It's the most mysterious verse in the Bible, chapter in the Bible, and so forth. But here's the way Joseph Smith reads it. He puts a very interesting insertion in here that makes a great deal of difference. Now this is the King James so far. And he brought him forth abroad, and he said, look now toward heaven, and tell the stars if thou be able to number them. And he said unto him, so shall thy seed be. So he shows him the stars, and he explains them. And now we come to the Joseph Smith part. And Abraham said, O Lord God, how wilt thou give me this land for an everlasting inheritance? And the Lord said, though thou wast dead, yet am I not able to give it to thee. And if thou shalt die, yet thou shalt possess it. What is this? He was dead, and he shall die. For the day cometh, Joseph Smith continues, that the Son of Man shall live. But how can he live if he be not dead? He must first be quickened. And it came to pass that Abraham looked forth, and he saw the days of the Son of Man, and was glad, and his soul found rest. And he believed the Lord, and the Lord counted it unto him for righteousness. Now there's no mention in the Bible of Abraham's having died before the promise was given him. Yet that's the whole theme of the apocryphal Abraham literature, that he has to die first. Or the Son of Man dying so that he should live, but he did have to. He died so that we could live. That is, as we noted, the correct point of view for the Egyptians. You must die first so you can live. Well, Abraham is not the only man to have this strange experience. Yet others are but a chosen few. Now there are some outstanding individuals who qualify for the cosmic tour with strict understanding that they shall give a full account to the others, less chosen but nonetheless holy people. The ascension stories, they're called that, were very numerous. You find them everywhere, but they were first noticed in the 1870s by August Haug and Wilhelm Arndt. They noticed that these ascension stories turn up everywhere in ancient literature if one is looking for them. But not the particular type of ascension which the Abraham story reports. There's something very special and unique. In the essential story, such as those which Faulkner finds a very large percentage of the story of the pyramid texts, Faulkner classifies as ascension stories, because they describe the king on his death, he's praised, and then he ascends to heaven. That's that. But these don't go that way. They give it a different, that's a typical ascension story, whether it's one of the saints or something else. In the normal ascension story, that's what happens. A person simply dies and goes to heaven with an escort. But in the Abraham variety, the hero goes to heaven before he dies. And in order to do that, he dies but does not die. That is the key. Abraham insisted on a view of the next world while I am still in the flesh, he said. And yet to get that view, his spirit must leave his body, it said, left his body. And its return is not a resurrection, but only a type. His real death must take place later on. And of course, this puzzled Moroni in the case of the three Nephites until he later had an explanation. The only way. The subjects of the Ascension's experience are pivotal figures signaled out for special assignments. Just a few patriarchs of their dispensations, men upon whom whole generations of followers depend for reassurance that their faith is not vainly vested. Missionaries to many generations, they leave their testaments as a witness to their calling. All are reluctant to die because they feel that their work is not done and because they have acquired as yet quite insufficient knowledge, as Abraham and Moses discovered. Their motives in wanting more and refusing to die until they got more are not selfish or egotistical. Abraham's apparent hunger for glory, I sought for the blessings of the fathers, desiring also to be one who possessed great knowledge and to possess greater knowledge and to be a father of many nations, holding the rights belonging to the father. You say, what an ego trip. Not for a moment. They express his purpose of imparting those blessings to others, to administer the same, to be a father, to be a prince of peace. He wanted what was granted, that all nations of the earth should be blessed in him. He wanted to do the same thing that God wants, to bring to pass the immortality and eternal life of man. This is my work and my glory, to bring the others to pass. And this is why Abraham and the others wanted. And these few selected men, because they were willing to do that, make a sacrifice, were able to go through this experience. But it's a terrible experience, a horror of great darkness, it's called in Genesis 15, that Abraham had to go through in order to achieve this. In this, he finds greater happiness and peace and rest for me, he says. And the same applies, as I say, to God himself in Moses 1:38. It was also with others, as we will see. Each sought that knowledge which would give him the greatest peace and understanding, which would be of the greatest benefit to mankind. Each was granted the supreme favor of a visit to heaven during his earthly lifetime, on condition that he would hand on his experience and his assurance to posterity in fully documented form, I say, with text, charts, and diagrams, as shown by his heavenly guide, either by his own hand or by dictation to another. It makes no difference, as we learn in the case of the scribe Somas. The record is to be accessible only to them that believe. A foremost scholar of the Jewish Apocrypha at the turn of the century was Kohler, who noted that at the time the Abraham Apocrypha, the two we've been talking about, became popular around the first century AD. Quoting him, Enoch had fallen into background. He'd been the hero before, and Moses hadn't arisen yet, so the big three are these. He says, Enoch had fallen into the background, and Abraham, like Moses, has become the center of mystic lore, as he puts it. These three are, we can call the big three, Enoch, Abraham, and Moses. The three most significant apocrypha to be recognized since the recent rediscovery of the apocalyptic, as recently as the 1960s, we're told, in Klaus Koch's book, is called the rediscovery. Its German title is more effective, different. Well, they are the two apocrypha of Abraham, Enoch, and then Moses ex officio. Well, by a convenient coincidence, it happens that Joseph Smith has left us extensive versions of just those three. He's given us a book of Enoch in Moses 6 and 8, long chapters, a book of Abraham, and a book of Moses. Our natural curiosity now turns to the book of Enoch with, of course, the hypocephalus in mind. And this is where my talk for today begins. And you can leave any time you want, because I get interested here. I like this very much. Of all the documents which have received renewed attention and respect with the rediscovery of apocalyptic, it's called, these three stand out by far above all the rest. And we've just considered the two of Abraham and the book of Enoch. The one thing the Bible tells us about Enoch is what? He walked with God and was not, for God took it. For God took him. He died and was not. He was the one, the man of two worlds. Remember, he runs the shuttle between the two worlds, which, in the process of time, takes all the people of Zion up to heaven. He's the man who's free to come and go all the time. He knows about the other world. And he's often mentioned with Elijah as one of those heroes who died but did not die. At the end of the world, Enoch and Elijah must turn together during the rule of the Antichrist. We're quoting the Evangelium Nicodemi from the 5th century. Must be put into death by him and arise after 3 days to be caught up into the clouds to meet the Lord. So he hasn't died yet. He will still have to die. He's one of those who died but did not die. The most enlightening among the many Enoch manuscripts is the long Hebrew account which Odeberg labeled the third Enoch. It opens with Enoch praying. Now it starts just like our typical hypocephalous story. I lifted my eyes and said, Lord of the universe, I pray thee that Kafsel the prince, that is Sith, that is Satan, who had smitten him and he's helpless, you see, that Kafsel the prince may not get power over me to throw me down from the heavens. Here we have the familiar opening prayer. Forthwith he sent the Metatron, an angel, and spreading his wings, he came to save me from their hands. He took me by the hand and he said, enter in the peace before the high and exalted king and behold the picture of the Merkabah. Now we're going to have three things mentioned here, the Merkabah, the Metatron, and the Shekinah, and everyone is a cover-up. They immediately clam up when they come to this theme. The rabbis aren't going to tell us a thing. As to the Merkabah, for example, well, here we are, we'll quote Jastrow here. The Merkabah was made like the chariot of him who created the worlds. What was it that took him to heaven, you see, the Merkabah? It's the divine chariot of Ezekiel. It is, the Genesis rabbi tells us, the patriarchs are the divine chariot. The secrets of the chariot are the deepest of secrets. They're always to be guarded. The Merkabah is the subject of much mystic speculation, but don't ask too much what it is. Of course, it just means wagon. It means what is all it means, Merkabah. It still does mean that. And the same thing. Well, as I say, when we get into this, people get very cagey. They don't want to tell us anything. Like Abraham in the Apocalypse, Enoch falls down in terror before the divine throne, and the angel puts him on his feet again. And though he passes through the gates, his presence in heaven is challenged by some as that of an earthling and an alien. Objections are overruled, and he's lifted up to a higher heaven. Always there's a series of heavens and so forth. The heavens, they are many. Remember, the Lord tells Abraham in the beginning, the heaven started out by saying, the heavens are many, they cannot be numbered unto man. So they visit lots of heavens in all of these, not just one. Objections are overruled and he's lifted to a higher heaven along with the Shekinah. Again, we get the Shekinah. And what is that? It means royal Sakana, the place where you dwell. It means the royal residence or royalty. It means the divine presence. It means holy inspiration. It means revelation. These are code words. I say the brethren always clam up when they approach these particular mysteries. Out of line. Where he's declared one of the elect from the beginning, even as Abraham was in the book of Abraham. And the Lord tells him, Enoch, that he knew him from the beginning and was declared one of the elect then. We're in the same story, is it? He sees the glorious throne and the opposing host and see how God has made me a throne similar to his own. Now that Abraham, that Enoch has a throne similar to his own. Even so, in the book of Moses 7:59, Enoch cries out to the Lord, thou hast made me and given me a right to thy throne, not of myself, but of thine own grace. This is the one thing that really impressed Matthew Black, who edited the Enoch text from the Dead Sea Scrolls. And but that throne passage, because you wouldn't find it anywhere else, and it really knocked him off. It puzzled him, among other things. Well, next Enoch is shown all the secrets of the universe and creation. Now he's shown the map again. He says, I watched intently. There was nothing on high nor in the depths that were withheld from me. Remember, Moses said he beheld the cosmos, every particle of it, is the way he puts it. All the secrets of the universe and creation I watched intently, he said. There was nothing on high nor in the depths withheld from me. There is placed on his head a crown like the disk of the sun, like Isaac's sun and moon crown, emanating rays in the four directions. Remember, the center of the crown is the sun of the full day, this one, with the four heads on it. Every hypocephalus has that, which is the sun at its fullest, of course, represents that. The supreme glory, in other words. But, and this crown was like that anyway. It says, like a disk of the sun emanating rays in the four directions. And on it the angel wrote with a flaming stylus the letters by which the earth and heaven and earth and seas were created. All the orders of the creation in which every letter shows on the flaming circle of his head. That's the Kabbalah in which all wisdom is put on one chart. See, we're getting something like a hologram here that's supposed to explain everything to you. It's supposed to culminate in it. The rising of the sun, moon, and the planets, it says. We're completely in the astronomical mode. Also, Enoch himself was surrounded by fire against Book of Dead 162, and you'll be surrounded by ample flames when you... And personally, he sat on the great throne as the judge, with princes standing before me on my right and my left. There's some real exaltation for Enoch. As another angel, Ashashel expounds that which is written concerning the inhabitants of the world, and weighs all the merits in the balance. The Metatron, well, there's another of those. Does it mean with a throne? Nobody agrees on what Metatron's supposed to mean, but it's somebody. It's supposed to be the Holy Ghost. See? That's a common name for Holy Ghost, but the Metatron, the one with the throne, that's the one what Matthew Black thinks it should be. But the Metatron took me by the hand and raised me upon his wings. He has to be carried up. That's your bird of light, you see, in the Egyptian version. And showed me all those letters on the throne of glory and everything else as well, including, as with Abraham, the spirits of the righteous that have not yet been created. So he shows them the pre-existent spirits. And the history of the world to its end. And all this was graven on the curtain of the Makom, that's the veil of the temple. Makom, the place where you enter, the point of passage between the two, the notch stella, as Hornung calls it, or as we'd say, where do two things come together, the confrontation and not still? Well, we have a name for it. Where they meet in one, the fuse. I'll think of it, don't worry. While his guide points out all the stars to him with his fingers, the angel always points it with his fingers. Well, the oldest document, Jewish document attributed to Enoch, according to J.T. Miller, who was the editor of this, he edited it. It was in the Dead Sea Scrolls, by far older than any Enoch account we had, and it comes so much closer to Joseph Smith than any of the others, and he kept it for 27 years and wouldn't show it to anybody else. Father Joseph Fitzmaier was here one summer, and he said, though he's a fellow Jesuit with Father Millick, who lives in Palestine, he was entrusted with this by the committee, the Rockefeller Committee, that assigned these various texts to various people to be edited. And he wouldn't let him see it. He says every time he came near, he'd hide it under his coat. He said he wouldn't let any, for 27 years, wouldn't let anybody see this Book of Enoch. Very strange, isn't it? Well, anyway, J.T. Millick, the editor of the text, he says it's the work of Egyptian Jews who guarded it as a most precious and secret volume. I should say so. In it, Enoch, quoting him, as a redivivus, one who returns from the other world, on leave from his sojourn in paradise, draws up in writing the scientific and religious teachings. And the fact that they were scientific is what prejudiced the world against them. As Carl Schmitt has shown, the great authority at the end of the 19th century, on documents, he said, this absolutely prejudiced with the doctors of the Jews, and the Christians would have nothing to do with it as soon as he brought science into it, because it was not spiritual. And it was not Aristotelian or anything like that. Science, it was out. And so they've hated and detested and damned this work and the rest of them, and threw them out by the 4th century. Well, the two go together here, the writing and the scientific and the religious. And in this work, Enoch, Millick believes, leads us with complete certainty to the Mesopotamian centers of scholarship. One more section here, allow me to leave. I'll talk all that here. Millick has supplied ancient Babylonian maps of the universe. This is why we get into hypocephalus here. Maps of the universe in which both the heavens and the earth are shown in their proper relationship with the mountain-ringed earth. There it is, you see. This is Babylonian maps of the earth and in the cosmos. They fit together. You can't separate heaven and earth, certainly not with the Babylonians. in which both the heavens and the earth are shown in their proper relationship with the mountain-ringed earth in the center of the starry sky. Such a map Millick has designated here as a map of the world of Enoch. Well, this isn't his, but this is the one that's published in the Morgan Land here, Gilshaw. And here's another one, another Babylonian map, yes. This one is, oh, we've got it backwards here. That's all right, you can read it here. The Bitter Sea, and show, notice this, right in the center, you'll see right in the center, I thought we had it in straight, right in the center is Babylon. It has to be the center of the universe, you see, and various ways, and this is the Bitter Sea, this is the Salt Sea, and then you get out to the starry heavens out here. But they put the earth in the picture. There is the sun in various phases, of course, and the interesting thing is that you have a seven-pointed star here, and well, let's go to another one before that thinks out. Yes, here's the Jewish conception of the same thing, following the Babylonian pattern. See, map, notice he calls it here, what Father Millick calls this is a map of the world of Enoch. Is this Enoch's world? Well, again, he drew his picture, he had it, puts the things in the various ways, Mesha, and various things, Nahar, Rabbah. This is the great river that surrounds the earth. It's very important, this rim. The great cosmic sea, the Nahar, that surrounds the earth. And so, and you notice, stars in various places. Well, we don't want to get involved in Choshek. This is outer darkness here. Oshka, the darkness out here. Ashaka, Rabbah, the great darkness. And here, this is outer space, and then you get the stars out there. That's a pretty good map. But we have... what we're getting to is the hypocephalus now, believe it or not. This is Unger, the Babylonian ones. The map Millick has designated as the map of the world of Enoch. The Egyptians had the same type of maps. They combined heaven and earth, designed carefully and deliberately after the pattern of the hypocephalus. And this is the interesting thing about them. Oh, this is a copy in between Babylon, the Babylonian world and the Hebrew world is this Tel al-Ghassal, very old, near the Dead Sea here. And this is one that's found in a house, a mural that's preserved of the cosmic map. It's connected with it. And Unger supplied that as sort of a go-between between the Babylonians and the Hebrews. But here, the Egyptians had these after the pattern of the hypocephalus. The ceilings of tomb chambers and lids of coffins from the 19th to the dynasty to the Greco-Roman period, way back there, you see, they display familiar discs with the names of various nomes of Egypt, and they bring Egypt into... Well, this is an example. This is just an outline. You see, the Pronos of the Great Temple. This is found at Philae in the outer section of the Pronos of the Great Temple. And here, of course, is our familiar pattern, and hypocephalus pattern, with the heaven and earth. It's supposed to be a map. Here's the zenith of the heavens, and here's the nadir, showing your... And it connects it with hypocephalus. And showing the hypocephalus definitely deals, as Joseph Smith says, with astronomical matters here, and the Pronos of the Great Temple. And and notice here is the Heperu, and here is the ram, showing the passing of time and the changing phases of the sun. Here is the newborn infant reborn in the center as you begin a new cycle here, all the familiar things, and the prow to prow boats and the rest of it that aren't on this picture. We'll go to another one there. This is better. Oh, this is, notice this one is based, this is a typical, notice you have the wings spread above, and outside you have, these are the 42 knowns of Egypt, and they're spaced according to their relative positions on the earth and to their relative positions under certain constellations in the sky. And this is supposed to represent their relative positions in the delta, you see. So this is a heavenly map, you notice. These are all stars along here. And these are this is the winged disc, the sun in space, the same thing here. And the figures that you find on hypocephali, following the familiar pattern, there's the shoe feathers, also the mat feathers. But it is an earthly map, and these are the gnomes of Egypt, the 42 gnomes of Egypt. So in the hypocephalus, we have a map of the earth and the sea and the space, which gave the inspiration to these people. They took the hypocephalus as their pattern to follow here. So it takes us right into this map business. The ceilings and tomb chambers. I had eight of these. Let's see if I have any more here.
Oh, no, this is the Joseph Smith one, but you're going to have the same sort of thing here. That's, oh, well, this shows us the four-headed ram. This is the important thing. You see that this thing with the Aleph crown, these are 3 degrees of glory, and this is they face in the four directions. Of course, when you're writing on a two direction on a flat sheet, you have to show the four directions some way, and that's the way you do it. This thing is a globe. It's always usually translated as disc, but it's actually a globe. If you look at Karnak, for example, on the Pyramidions and the Obelisks, you'll see whenever they show the globe of ray, it's deeply cut, almost to make it a freestanding ball. They cut it in so deeply to show that it is not supposed to be a flat disc, it's supposed to be a globe. And that's supposed to be, but how would you show it otherwise than having faced in all the four directions? Well, that these plans were an imitation of the hypocephalon, that they were made in imitation of it, is omitted by everybody today. There's a JEA that gives the 8 examples. In fact, many have sent me copies of these. Well, so I'm going to end here. Let's end with this. We've gone through all these strange things and still haven't parted company with the hypocephalus. And we meet Abraham and Enoch every time we turn around here. See, Joseph Smith is in this thing up to his neck, isn't he? I don't know how. I can see why everybody shies away from it. They don't want to get involved in this sort of thing, because you don't have to look very far when you start coming up and saying, well, now, wait a minute, he must have had something here. That's what affected some of the people that I have talked with. They shy off. They're very, very timid about engaging this sort of thing. Well, you've suffered me long enough. Thank you very much. We'll take up here. It gets good here, but I had to have that long introduction. I'm sorry to have led you all around Robin Hood's barn, but we've never left home all the time, don't worry. Come back to it. Thanks.